Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Last year's devastating hurricanes were a sober reminder of the destructive impact of climate change on coastal communities here in the U.S. and around the globe. Over the past few months, several scientific reports have shown an acceleration in sea level rise. A recent study by scientists from Arizona State University and UC Berkeley suggests that a combination of sea level rise and sinking could submerge parts of the Bay Area. The San Francisco International Airport could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by the year 2100. By the end of the century, Foster City and Treasure Island could also see higher levels of flooding. So what does this mean for people who live in these communities and for the greater Bay Area? And what needs to be done to prevent the destruction of our coastal communities? Today, we are joined by Dr. Roland Bergman, professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. He's co-author of the new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. And Dr. Roland Bergman joins us from the studios of the Journalism School at UC Berkeley. Hi, Roland. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. Well, your study has received so much media attention because of the dire predictions. The San Francisco International Airport could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by 2100. I mean, the New York Times had an incredible graph showing the areas that could be submerged. First off, there have been a lot of studies about sea level rise. What did you and your colleagues aim to really look at in your study?
Right. We already knew that we were in a dire situation before from the sea level rise, because all the projections have been very consistent in predicting up to many feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. So what we really added to that picture is that in addition to the sea level rise, there are substantial areas around the Bay Area and probably in many other areas around the world where in addition to that we have the sinking or subsidence, we call it. And in some places, like SFO, the sinking is actually significantly faster than the sea level rise. So it just makes everything somewhat worse.
You know what? I'd love to talk about the specifics here, because nowadays we hear sea level rise. We see that in headlines on a regular basis. But can you tell us what that actually means?
So the sea level rise, which currently is at about 2 millimeters per year, so a small fraction of an inch, it's ultimately due to climate change. So we have melting of polar ice sheets, we have melting of glaciers in mountain ranges, and we have the warming of the oceans that itself, by expanding the volume of the oceans a little bit, contribute as well. So it's the warming of the oceans and the melting of the ice sheets that slowly but surely, and already for many decades, have added to the water in our oceans and therefore added to sea level rise.
And how do you go about studying sea level rise?
So sea level rise has been monitored or studied for a long, long, long time. Already in the late 19th century, tidal gauges in harbors, and San Francisco has one that has a measurement that started in the late 1800s, that above and beyond all the noise coming from tides and storms and other factors have recorded that very slow but enduring rise of sea level. And those tide gauges exist around the world. And so we have been able to quantify that quite well for some time. And then more recently, using satellite measurements, satellite altimetry, the research community has been able to really confirm that at a global scale.
We are now learning that sea level rise is accelerating. A new study recently came out. We're finding one at the NASA website. Global sea level rise has been accelerating in recent decades rather than increasing steadily. This is according to a new study based on 25 years of NASA and European satellite data. So can you talk about this? Did scientists expect that it would be increasing steadily, and now you're learning that it's actually really accelerating?
Right. So the official predictions, and those go back to a report by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. This is a multi-volume document that tries to really establish that climate change is happening and what its effects are. And so in that report, there are a number of scenarios that, depending on how much we do about climate change and global warming, what the outcome would be for sea level rise. And those were the numbers we mostly relied on in our study. But as you say, in more recent years with these satellite measurements, it appears that, if anything, the melting rates in Antarctica and also in Greenland have been underestimated, and therefore the sea level rise may actually turn out to be faster than we thought, or is already faster than we might have anticipated.
How do you determine the connections between sea level rise and the recent horrific hurricanes that we have seen in Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, the British Virgin Islands? There's been a lot more attention now on the impacts of climate change on sea level rise and the connection between that and hurricanes. As a scientist, how do you make the connections?
So I think there are two relevant connections. So one is that other scientists have also proposed that the rate and intensity of hurricanes appears to be and will be getting worse as the Earth's atmosphere is heating up and therefore has more energy to work with and more warmer oceans that help power these hurricanes. So that's one effect. And you know, that takes a long time to establish because every year has different numbers of hurricanes. The other connection is that when you have sea level rise, then essentially the risk of low-lying areas to the hurricane hazard and flooding will increase because your levees and seawalls won't stand as high, and so therefore the impact of a hurricane will inevitably get worse with time. So I think both of those aspects play a role.
And then the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, came out with a report suggesting that coastal communities should expect much more frequent flooding in the coming decades as sea levels rise. And many places that are dry today could flood by the end of the century.
Right. So that's another reflection of that the background level, right, this couple millimeter per year increase will just bring the ocean closer to the land and therefore increase the hazard. And again, then the other question is, does the intensity of flooding from not just hurricanes, but any storm systems, precipitation peaks increasing, and therefore making these sea level fluctuations from year to year and day to day even just so much greater and therefore so much more hazardous?
So based on the research that's been done and the study that you and your colleagues have conducted, how alarming is this?
Well, it's all the pieces in the puzzle, you know, should add to the alarm. With our study finding our measurements showing that we have these areas around the bay sinking at these very high rates, that's just another contributor to making the flooding hazard somewhat worse.
And talk a little bit about how the sinking happens.
So the sinking, so we're just measuring the vertical displacement of the Earth's surface. And we use these satellite measurements, radar measurements to do that. Now, what's actually happening is a number of processes. So one is many of those areas, including Treasure Island, including SFO, are on landfill. So this is reclaimed land. This is material, sometimes trash, sometimes other debris, that's still compacting. It's still sinking under its own weight and therefore producing subsidence at the surface. Another factor is, and that may play a role, again, in both of these areas and some of the others, is that around the bay we have what we call bay mud. Those are really young sediments that were deposited since the end of the last ice age, so just in the last few thousand years. And those, again, are wet clay materials that are still compacting and consolidating and producing surface subsidence. So both of these factors are primary contributors in the Bay Area. Another factor that is probably not as big a problem anymore here in the Bay Area because we've done something about it, but is a huge problem in many other coastal cities, is sinking that is due to groundwater levels dropping because we're taking too much water out of the earth. Mm-hmm. And when we remove water from the subsurface for drinking water, then that also causes land subsidence. And this used to be a huge problem in San Jose, for example, in the early 1900s. And because people recognized that already back then, when the land around the bay was sinking by as much as 6 to 8 feet, to 10 feet even, they knew they had to stop using so much water from the ground. And that's when we started importing water from the Sierras.
Hmm. That's very interesting. So taking water from the ground for drinking water, there have also been a lot of stories recently about how the agricultural industry is affecting this because they're also taking massive amounts of water from the ground.
Exactly. So these last few years when we were in a drought, 2012 to 2015, there was way much more water taken out of the ground than being replenished, mainly in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. And so the same kind of measurements that we use here in the Bay Area show us that there was very rapid subsidence by many, many inches in the Central Valley. Now, the Central Valley currently is not a coastal area, so this doesn't lead to flooding, but produces many other risks. In the Delta region, the Sacramento Delta, you have those two factors coming together. We have the delta that, due to the subsidence from water use, is already below sea level and it's protected by levees. And so there's a fine balance there. And the recent water use, people also worried, might have, made those levees sink a little bit more than we should be comfortable with, too.
How much does the land settle under what we would consider to be normal conditions?
So if we have a well-managed aquifer, so currently in the Santa Clara Valley, so around San Jose, the Santa Clara Water District keeps the water level relatively steady and at a level that doesn't go deep enough to produce this very rapid subsidence. So what we see there now is kind of an up and down every year and through the seasons of maybe half an inch or so. And by keeping the water at that level, that is really not a problem. The problem comes into play if the water is being withdrawn below previously lowest values. Then all the water that's in that sediment is being pulled out, and the sediment collapses under its own weight and produces subsidence that can be a foot or more in a relatively short time.
Today on Your Calls One Planet series, we're speaking with Dr. Roland Bergman, professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. He's co-author of a new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. He and his colleagues from Arizona State University have just conducted a study suggesting that a combination of sea level rise and sinking would submerge parts of the Bay Area. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so we cannot take any of your phone calls. So here's what the study found. The San Francisco International Airport could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by the year 2100. And Professor Bergman, we are in the year 2018. That's just 82 years away. I mean, it's really hard to imagine that this could happen. But this is what you're projecting.
Right. So some people might say, oh, 80 years, I won't be around anymore by then.
Well,
so
our kids and our grandkids will.
Right? Indeed. And obviously, we picked 2100 as the year for which we calculated numbers and developed these flooding scenarios as to where the water would be on average under the current rates of sea level rise and land subsidence. But, of course, this is a steady process. So even in just the next decade or so, we will see more and more the effect of these processes and the increased flooding in many areas. And we see that already. During times of peak tides, king tides, and during especially big storms, we already see more flooding in areas that used to sit high and dry. And I know there's people who actually go out and try to sort of keep records of where the flooding is during these king tides. And I think they have shown that that has been getting worse already, simply because of that inevitable sea level rise and land subsidence contributing to that problem.
Can we talk about specifics? Because the sections of your study that have received the most media attention are about the San Francisco airport being underwater, parts of it, by 2100. And then by the end of the century, Foster City and Treasure Island could also see higher levels of flooding. But can we talk specifics here? What would you say stood out for you the most in your report?
Well, we had already seen evidence of some of these subsiding areas for some time, Treasure Island in particular. And as best as I know, people have been aware of this for some time just by doing local measurements, doing leveling measurements, and maybe even already noting that sometimes the water levels rise to uncomfortable levels. In places like Foster City, which is, you know, a residential area, and the San Francisco airport, which obviously is a multi-billion dollar business, the impact just seems so much more striking. And presumably, that also means the mitigation measures, the protection measures, have to be taken to protect those. Because in some areas where we have essentially very little development and relatively natural systems, one of the options you have is to let nature take over and to develop tidal marshes and wetlands, which can actually naturally keep up with the sea level rise by depositing sediments and forming kind of a buffer protection zone to the land behind those wetlands. And that's what's being done in some of these salt ponds in the southern San Francisco Bay. But clearly, that's not an option for some of those more developed and high-value areas.
Speaking of wetlands, in 2016, California voters approved $500 million in new funding over the next 20 years for bay wetlands restoration and flood control. And according to the San Jose Mercury News, the first grants are scheduled to go out next month. What effect do you think this will have on this problem?
I think that's a really valuable thing to do. We can't engineer our way around flooding problems ultimately. And I know that in many areas, people have come to realize that just building levees and seawall to keep back the sea is not always the best option. So in areas where we have the ability to develop these wetlands and let nature develop this protection zone that it ultimately represents, that may be one of the better options and well worth the investment.
Can you describe how these protection zones work?
So essentially, in tidal marshes and wetlands, you have whatever the grasses and other organisms that are able to exist there grow. You have coastal streams bring sediments to the wetlands. They obviously also represent a habitat for seabirds, et cetera. And because the land keeps up with the sea level rise, because of the addition of sediments, that ultimately allows that land to keep up with the bay water level and therefore protect the areas behind those wetlands from flooding because they're so much further away from the seashore.
Now, this was a $500 million measure. And again, the grants will start going out next month. In this Mercury News piece, Patrick Barnard, a research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, said, how much are we going to spend to defend the shoreline? In all likelihood, parts of the Bay Area are going to look like New Orleans one day. It's not in our nature to get out of the way and retreat, and that's going to be very expensive. He said that we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars.
New Orleans is a great example. There we have very rapid subsidence. It's gotten worse because one of the things that in the Delta system, right, this is the Mississippi River Delta, we're now lacking the floods that used to bring sediment to the area around New Orleans. So that makes the subsidence there even faster. And there, especially after Hurricane Katrina, the Army Corps of Engineers and local administrations decided to invest billions of dollars to build even higher seawalls. And I just read recently that even there, the sense is that this may not be enough when it comes to ultimately protecting people. So the costs are staggering, and so we really have to think very long-term to think about what the appropriate solutions and measures will be.
And how do you think this should be conducted? Because, I mean, this was a regional measure. In San Francisco, a recent bill was just introduced, SB 2578, which would provide California with a mechanism to contribute to the Seawall Earthquake Safety Program and would generate about $55 million in the first 10 years of the program. And specifically, it would deal with the aging seawall against San Francisco's waterfront.
Right. So seawalls are obviously not indestructible. And if we rely on seawalls, and if we want to protect high-value lands from the oceans, then we have to make sure that we build them to the highest quality. We don't want to have a major storm proved to us that our seawall was not properly designed. And earthquake shaking is another problem. Many levees and seawalls are not built very sturdily so as to withstand the damage they could suffer when there's an earthquake. So that clearly adds to the cost of building up these protections.
Do you think that so coastal cities up and down the state of California are really going to have to take drastic measures?
Right. And I think it's going to be a very difficult case-by-case situation, right? You have to go through the cost benefits and evaluate that. And there's always the sense that maybe we make it too easy for people and businesses to develop areas that we know to be at flooding risk, and so some measures might also include discouraging people from moving to these low-lying areas, or even encouraging them to leave where they currently live. And as you can imagine, that's not an easy thing to make happen. So this is a time of difficult choices, and it's going to remain that way for some time to come.
Today on Your Calls One Planet series, we're speaking with Dr. Roland Bergman, professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. He's co-author of a new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. Thank you. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Dr. Roland Bergman, professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. He is co-author of a new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. He and his colleague, a scientist from Arizona State University, suggests that a combination of sea level rise and sinking will submerge parts of the Bay Area. The San Francisco airport could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by the year 2100. And by the end of the century, Foster City and Treasure Island could also see higher levels of flooding. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Before the break, Dr. Bergman, you were talking about businesses that set up along coastal communities. And I mean, we're seeing that in San Francisco. It's just exploding. How do you think city officials should deal with this as all of this money pours into a city like San Francisco? Well, as your research shows, what's going to happen to these businesses by the year 2100? And what should their responsibility be?
I guess I'm glad I'm just a scientist, not a city official. I'm not sure what the right thing to do is. There's always this fine balance between wanting to encourage business development and making the most of the land that we have. I think the key thing with a lot of these environmental and climate change related hazards is you have to think very long term. We really have to think, as you said much earlier, about how this will affect not just us in the next few years and our economy, but how it will affect our economy and our children's economy in decades to come. And we're not used to thinking very long term, it seems to me. And so I think that is, decisions have to be made that go beyond the election cycle and short-term economic benefit.
What can you tell us about Treasure Island? It is now the site of a redevelopment project. As many as 8,000 new homes are expected to be built on Treasure Island. And this was built in the 1930s on top of landfill.
Right. So Treasure Island was built really out of nowhere next to Yerba Buena Island for a world exhibition in 1939, and so it was filled up with landfill and rubble in the years before and then developed for the exhibit, and since has been used at relatively modest levels by the development there. And so I also hear there are big developments and plans to develop it much further, including maybe some high-rise buildings. So I would assume, I'm pretty sure that when it comes to these development plans, that's similar to, say, South San Francisco and some other areas in San Francisco, they would plan the engineering so as to ultimately go through the landfill material and build supports that keep the houses above the water level. The subsidence that we see is limited to the kind of top northwest corner, maybe 20% of the island, where it's really fast. And so I would hope that in that area, they wouldn't try to develop that unless they take some really specific measures to stop the subsidence and build up the land before doing so.
Hmm. Let's talk about areas that will change that are not affected by sinking or subsiding. You know, flooding is also a huge problem, but what happens when formerly dry land becomes flooded?
Well, as you might imagine, initially it seems to be just a nuisance. When you have a bigger storm, a few basements may flood, or you see water on the street making police need to divert people for a little while. So whenever you have high tide or big storms, you will have a temporary effect. And then as time goes on and on, this will just get worse. And in our study, those maps we created as to where we expect the flooding to occur, this is just considering average water levels. So when we have these high tide events and storms, things are actually temporarily much worse. So in more detailed scenarios, and those have already been generated, just thinking about the sea level rise alone, you need to take into consideration what happens if we have a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood or just, you know, the biggest tide of the year. That will come into play and needs to be considered.
And what would you say about these areas, the places that are going to be at risk of flooding? How do you think that should be dealt with?
So again, it's sort of the way it creeps up on you that will make that so difficult. It's not going to be like, oh, by the year X, everybody should move out of Foster City or out of Alameda for that matter. But it'll just sort of slowly get worse that at some point people have to decide to invest a lot of money in protection systems or take other measures that might mitigate that hazard. So there's sort of this punctuated effect that you keep seeing and getting worse that ultimately has to drive decision makers to make some difficult choices.
Dr. Roland Bergman is professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley, a co-author of a new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. It found that the airport could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by 2100. By the end of the century, Foster City and Treasure Island could also see higher levels of flooding. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Dr. Bergman, what else can you tell us about just how we should really think about these issues? Because every Monday we have a One Planet series where we talk about everything from plastic pollution to coral reef bleaching. And now we're talking about the effects of sea level rise and flooding. I mean, specifically on this issue, since we live right on the coast here, how should we really think about this issue? And, you know, people want to demand change. So what are your thoughts about that?
So one of the most important things clearly is just to be aware. Awareness of risks is the first step towards doing something about them. And that's true especially for these natural systems that take so long to remind us what's happening. And so in that sense, you know, I think the media attention that our study is getting right now is a good sign that people do worry about those things, and hopefully that will also mean that they are willing to do something about it. So clearly, awareness and making decision makers aware that this is an important issue, just as important as some more short-term problems we are facing, is really, really important. And then, secondly, making sure that whatever we do is based on the best information and science available, so to also invest in improving our knowledge about all the factors involved and all the options that we might have, and maybe not don't even know yet we do have as to how to address that.
There's an effort called Resilient by Design. It's a new effort to get people to really try to get creative about sea level rise. And according to reports, various plans will come out in May. Are you familiar with this?
I've heard about it a little bit. I don't know the details, but I think that's exactly the kind of program that I think is valuable to allow people to think really hard about what different options and different measures might be and really work through those and test them out. So those kind of programs, as well as the programs that just characterize the risk as accurately as possible, are really important investments to make to give us the chance to make smart decisions.
According to Bay Nature, after Hurricane Sandy gave New York City a wake-up call about these issues in 2012, an effort was launched called Rebuild by Design, and that garnered $920 million in federal disaster relief funds to launch projects to remake the waterfront, for example, to deal with wetlands. And the one in the Bay Area is called Resilient by Design, and it's modeled after New York's efforts. So far, it's got about $4.6 million from the Rockefeller Foundation. And again, this is a challenge to various scientists who are working on these issues. Andy Gunther was quoted saying, "I'm just a scientist and I struggle to provide the visions that can stimulate our elected officials and the public to really rally for the kind of changes that we need to make."
So the Sandy example is a good one. There we had a disaster, a hurricane. Same for Katrina in New Orleans, that ultimately made people do something about the problem. So here in the Bay Area, when we think about disasters, it's the earthquakes that we're most worried about. And that's when we talk about improving earthquake mitigation effects. The sea level rise is this slow but steady phenomena that makes it much harder to get people to energize, motivated by this very slow, multi-decadal process. So it's really good to see that efforts are being made, maybe partly by seeing the sudden disastrous effects that these big storm events can have. So maybe we benefit in a way from these wake-up calls.
When the hurricane hit, it's the Sandy hurricane, that was in 2012. What changes did you see that impressed you that you'd like to see maybe tried here?
Well, again, mostly just that people really take action because they see how this is an inevitable and inevitably worse problem in times to come and should be one of the highest priorities, not somewhere down the line of what governments should do. And it clearly takes the coordination and collaboration of all the different state, city, and county governments to work together to develop these programs and find the funds and make the investments to create these protective systems that can make a big difference.
And then it's also about urban design, right? I mean, as we were talking about all of the development that is planned for Treasure Island, the development that is planned all along the coastal areas of California, because that's where people really want to live near the water. So we also, city planners, really need to start thinking about these decisions. And not just, you know, right now in California, we need so much housing. But what comes first, the housing that we need so desperately, or do we think long term and say, well, you might live here for a couple of decades, but what happens if this area is underwater in 2100?
Right. So we have these conflicting pressures from rising populations, mm-hmm. from the quality of life aspects that you mentioned as well. We want to be near the water. And so that obviously makes this especially difficult. It's interesting that, in general, some of these hazards that we're facing, and that goes for earthquakes and floods, et cetera, they tend to be worst in places we like to live because they affect areas near coastal regions. And when it comes to earthquakes, near regions that feature hills and mountains and invite us to be there. So there's this nature human interaction that we have to find a way around. And there's clearly no easy solution because it's not that we're just going to flee the coast and head to the mountains to solve this problem. That's
right.
Not going to happen.
Well, and what's so interesting when you think about urban planning is after Harvey happened, so many of us kind of got a crash course about zoning laws in Texas, in Houston, and there are very few zoning laws. In fact, hardly any at all. If you've ever been to Houston, I mean, the freeway system there is just really unbelievable. There's buildings everywhere, freeways everywhere. And after that happened, there was so much reporting about how this really was a disaster caused by human decisions to live in hurricane zones without taking some of these precautions and these measures that we're talking about today.
Right. And I heard that in some large neighborhoods, people lived there not actually being aware that those were slated to be flooding zones by design, reservoirs they're even called, if worst-case scenarios happen. So I think some people feel like there was even misinformation, that people were not made aware of that eventually when a storm of the magnitude of Harvey hits, the effects would be as disastrous that we then saw happen there. And Houston is another area that's very low-lying, that experiences subsidence from all these different processes we talked about earlier. And those clearly contributed, in addition to this storm being especially powerful in terms of the rain that fell during the hurricane, all those things combined to make that flooding event so disastrous.
We did a show about that, and there was some great reporting from Reveal and the Texas Tribune, and they found that developers built thousands of homes in Houston inside a reservoir, a 50-square-mile area that's not just flood-prone, but it's designed to flood. And many residents didn't even know about this because there's no laws requiring anyone to tell them. So after Hurricane Harvey, they were left with destroyed homes and little recourse.
Right. And whoever had to make that decision to let that water flood those areas to protect other areas, so it had to be a difficult decision to make, can't feel too great about that.
So it sounds like really people need to be educated on these issues and then pressure politicians to not just build, to really think about these issues and the consequences.
I think that's right. So people need to be informed first and foremost, and then take the right action, including activism in cases maybe necessary to push us into the right direction as a whole.
Dr. Roland Bergman is professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley and co-author of a new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. He found that the International Airport in San Francisco could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by 2100. By the end of the century, Foster City and Treasure Island could also see higher levels of flooding. You can find more information about this important study at yourcallradio.org. And this is our One Planet series. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Professor Bergman, I want to ask you a bigger question now about climate change. You know, given the fact that the Trump White House and the EPA, not only do they not believe in climate change, but they are every day pushing for deregulation. They're opening up federal lands and oceans to gas and oil drilling. I mean, we're definitely not going to see the kind of sound climate policies that we need from the federal government. What do you think about, you know, where that leaves us? Obviously, it has to happen at the state and local levels.
It is very, very scary. And clearly, we're walking backwards when we should be pushing forward at this time. As you hinted, there are things that states and local governments can do to keep pushing into the right direction in terms of taking some measures. It's also important to try to stop some of those efforts by filing lawsuits, which is being done. The NRDC and other organizations play an especially important role to just slow this process down and hopefully will be successful in not having some of these measures go away by the time this administration is over.
Do you think that this can be done at the state and local levels?
Well, the state of California is obviously kind of a role model there, and our governor has committed to keep pushing and to keep organizing with other states and countries elsewhere to still take the kind of measures when it comes to mitigating climate change and other big long-term problems that we really need to face up to. So I think things can be done, but it's not the same thing as the leading economy in the Western world as a whole making that a first priority.
We do so many shows about climate change, and I always like to ask, you know, if we had an administration that actually believed I believe in the science, right? Believed in climate change and put the money into solving these huge problems that we have and passed very strong legislation on these issues. Dr. Bergman, what kind of legislation would you want to see? I mean, what's near the top of your list?
Well, we had an administration not so long ago that was serious about climate change, but even then it was quite apparent that there weren't easy decisions to make. Mm-hmm. Joining the Paris Agreement and agreeing to some of those measures was a non-trivial effort and difficult to push through Congress. I wouldn't claim to know what is the secret bullet. I think it has to be a global effort. So I think engagement with the rest of the world and other nations to really make comprehensive change is especially important and especially challenging. But ultimately, this has to be a worldwide effort. There's always the saying, oh, what can we do if China or India are still growing and polluting even faster than ever before? It just means it really has to be a global effort. And it's obviously not an easy one, but it's one that has to be taken, given that it's so obvious where the world is headed if we don't.
And so many countries around the globe are really taking action on this. What are you watching right now? What is exciting you right now in other countries?
Well, certainly over the last few decades, the increased reliance on renewable energy that for a long time people had predicted could never make up a significant percentage of a country's energy use. I think we do see in some European countries that is not so, and that as we enhance the technologies of renewables, can actually make economically sense. So it's always good when good science, good human ingenuity makes the solution that's good for our environment also the solution that's good for our long-term economic benefit. So those things are especially encouraging.
When you look at other parts of the globe, what really concerns you when you think about sea level rise and sinking?
The Bay Area is obviously the area that we focused on in our study, but in large part, we also see it as a model study as to a hazard that's affecting most all coastal cities in the world. And if you look at Ho Chi Minh City, Dhaka in Bangladesh, Jakarta in Indonesia, and many other multi-million people cities, they face a much larger problem. The subsidence there is often much faster, and the flooding risk is much higher. And so I hope that with the kind of science and studies that we have undertaken here, that at least we can also start to better recognize and mitigate that problem in so many other areas that are facing much higher pressures to develop and have much less resources to counter these effects than we do.
And as we said earlier, your study has received attention from the New York Times to local TV stations. Have you heard from politicians? What has the reaction been from politicians in Sacramento and cities in California?
I have not heard from politicians. Now, I've heard from some private people. I've heard from a number of organizations and that are engaged in mitigating climate change, and we're very eager to to be able to work with the data that we produce that can be included in these efforts to characterize and mitigate hazard. But I haven't really had much engagement with the political sector.
Mm-hmm. And what is next? What's the next study on your list?
Well, on this particular topic, one thing that we just started talking with colleagues at the U.S. Geological Survey is how we can expand that up and down the California coastline. In fact, we talked with Patrick Bernard, who you mentioned earlier. He was saying, well, they really want to enhance their ability to forecast these hazards much better elsewhere in the state. And I think the kind of observations that we developed here for the Bay Area should be quite valuable in some of those other areas as well.
Hmm. You know, when you were talking about other areas, I was just thinking about how some cities have a lot of resources and other cities don't. And that's why it's so important for the state to really take action. So, say, San Francisco might be able to find the money to improve their waterfront, but the Central Valley, where we're going to see massive flooding, might not have the money to deal with this.
That is very true. I mean, that's why we have governments that are there for larger populations, such as state governments and federal governments, where it is really important to see that as a priority for the whole to make sure that all these areas are being considered with.
Well, Dr. Bergman, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Roland Bergman is professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley and co-author of a new study about global climate change and local risks to the San Francisco Bay Area. He and his colleague found that the San Francisco International Airport could see half of its runways and taxiways underwater by 2100, just 82 years from now. By the end of the century, Foster City and Treasure Island could see higher levels of flooding. And you can find more information about the study at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to our past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can find all of our One Planet shows at yourcallradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Josh Wilner is our social media producer. Ashley Ann Krigbaum is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thank you for joining us.